Here's something you may not have known. I didn't know this. April is Financial Literacy Month. And with just looking at the world, a little snapshot of what we're living in 2023, inflation, interest rates, savings, budgeting. These are things as adults we talk about an awful lot, but maybe the younger kids in our lives and our teenagers, they have no idea what's going on. And a lot of times, I've noticed that we give the younger generation such a hard time. But we can't get mad at our children when they don't know what they don't know, right? It's that same concept as when our children are first born. When they come into the world, they don't know anything. So how can we expect our teens and our children to understand the pressures financially that adults are facing with things like inflation and interest rates and why don't waste food because eggs cost an astronomical amount right now? How can we expect them to understand it if they do not get taught in financial skills? And so this morning, we're joined by Greg Mercet, who is a certified financial planner, to kind of give us some tips, explain some ways that we could teach our kids these financial skills at home. Greg, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Melissa. It's early for me. I'm on the West Coast here.
Oh, my gosh. So what time is it for you? Like 4?
Anything crazy, it's 4 o'clock in the morning.
Wow. Wow. Well, thank you for getting up early. It means
absolutely.
An awful lot. Yes. I mean, I have a 4.5-year-old at home, and so I think I'm a little early on the teaching financial skills. Maybe not. You can correct me. But I do remember it wasn't an incredibly long time ago that I was a freshman in college calling my mom and dad about how to balance a checkbook and what does this really mean and why does this cost so much more than it did a few years ago. You know, I think that a lot of kids, teens, go into their young adult years and they don't know why. They don't know how to budget and they don't know why they run out of money so quickly and they don't know why they have to cut back. Tell us just in general what we're looking at in society. And has this been a problem for a long time?
Yeah, so first things first, I think you're really close to starting to teach your kid here. 5 years old, I think, is where you start teaching. I think they really start to get it. And I think that's a great time to start. You mentioned something about balancing a checkbook, okay? This phrase right there in and of itself tells us why we need to start teaching our kids about this. The nature of money has completely changed. Mm. We don't balance checkbooks anymore. Nobody has checkbooks.
Right. You're right. You're right.
We very rarely write a check. Mm-hmm. And so we've got to start teaching the next generation differently. And I believe we need to teach them with technology because they get it. They're good at it. Plus, it actually makes it easier to teach them. And I know in the past, it's like parents freak out about teaching their kids about this. They'd rather teach them anything but money because they're probably not that great at it themselves. But if you leverage technology and you just are fairly consistent, they're going to get it. They're going to get it.
But does that mean, Greg, that we, the adults, have to be great at technology? Like when you say we need to use technology, do you mean apps? Like what are you suggesting?
Yes. I mean, and you don't have to be super great at it yourself. I mean, all of us have some apps that we use for something, right? And so, you know, like with BusyKid, like we've made it so easy for parents, literally. Imagine telling your kid, okay, I want to teach you about money. I'm going to give you some chores to do. You're going to come bust it out, do the chores. You're going to get some money. And then we're going to split that money up into three areas. Save and invest in one area, then share, and then spend. Like, that's pretty simple. Mm-hmm. Like, anybody gets that. And that's what we do as adults. We go to work. We earn some money. We save or invest in, like, a 401k or something. We share by giving to church or charity, something we care about. And then we spend the rest. And we usually do it on a card. So that's what we've created, is a little ecosystem that leverages technology in a very simple way, and any parent can figure that out and help their kid learn it.
So we're talking to Greg Mercet this morning, a certified financial planner. And yes, my understanding, Greg, is you are the CEO of what is it called, and is this the technology you're suggesting?
Yes, it's called BusyKid.
BusyKid.
So we literally say, get your kid busy doing something that they actually are going to use in their life. Not just scrolling endlessly and mindlessly about stuff. But after you teach your kids not to steal and beat people up, you know, you got to teach them about money, because they're going to be using money decision-making every single day of their lives and make millions of financial decisions. So if they don't get good at it, it's going to haunt them for their whole lives, like it does many Americans. So changing that dynamic really changes the way that their life can turn out.
So I downloaded it just now as you're talking to me. Busy kid.
It's
Well, you know, I mean, listen, I may have balanced a checkbook when I was 20 years old, but and I know that's not really a thing anymore, but I do know how to download an app. That I can do. I'm not that tech savvy, but and my listeners know this too, by the way. The only reason I have a smartphone is because I literally need it to be a reporter, but I'm not tech savvy at all. Like, don't ask me to hook up your TV. No way. Nope. I have no idea. It seems very simple, though. So I'm creating an account right now. Busy kid. It has it looks like it's a little boy in blue or a little person with a dollar sign and a cape on the person. Is that correct?
There we go. That's it.
Okay. So I'm downloading it. Let's see. Yeah. You keep going, Greg.
This is giving kids, literally, this is giving them life experiences that are going to help them in the future, right? So give them chores to do, let them earn some money. And if you're like, I'm not a chore person, they just need to do it because they're part of this family. I get it. That's fine. We actually have a feature called auto allowance where you can just set it, where you pay your kid every Friday or every 1st and 15th of the month. That kind of sounds familiar, right?
Yeah, that sounds an awful lot like my paycheck.
Yeah, exactly right. So this is like reality, right? Mm-hmm. And once they learn that they get paid, then what do they do with the money? And I think if they can have experiences with money early, starting like your kid, 5 years old, you know, they're going to be pretty good at it by the time they're 15 or 16, when they think they know everything. And then they're going to be really set up for the future. So kids learn best by doing stuff. And so put that power in their hands, and you better watch out. I have 6 kids. I know, it's crazy.
Wow,
and
God bless you. That's amazing.
I know, right? It's great. And 5 of them have left the nest, and all 5 of them have had more than $10,000 saved up before they left. I think that's amazing. And
that's amazing.
Because I'm paying them $200 to wash the car. I can tell you that much. But they can learn early.
Good job, Dad. Good job. I'm serious. Yeah. That's really amazing. Hold on, Greg, because I want to keep talking to you. I find you to be very interesting, and I also feel, a little bit badly. I had no idea you were on the West Coast. I totally would have, like, pre-recorded you. I had no idea you were going to get up at 4 a.m. I feel horrible. To be fair, though, I had no idea. No, I'm so sorry. Greg Mercet is here, the creator of Busy Kid and also a certified financial planner. So I wanted to let people know, because I had the commercial break to set up a profile. Takes about 30 seconds, by the way. Looks like it costs you $4 a month, so $48 for the year. How long is this program, you know, I would say good for? Is that the best way to put it, Greg? Like, I know you said you could start as early as 5, but are these concepts that you should be using every year till they leave the nest? Is it something that you're like, all right, I got it down to a science, so after a year, I may not have to continue? I mean, I know this is your business, but ideally or effectively, how long should your kids be on this program to really see, like, your kids are super prepped, which is very impressive. So how long would you say?
I think that's a great question. I think it's literally like 5 or 7 to like 15 to 17. So it's like a decade. Okay. Think of it as the decade to really nail this money thing with your kid. Mm-hmm. You got them around. And it's going to take some time, right?
Yeah.
Practice makes perfect. And especially when it comes to money, like, there's a lot of things they got to learn. And the best way to do it is to empower them to start making decisions. I would much rather see a kid, like, make a bunch of mistakes when they're 11 than when they're 23, right? And they're, like, making these big mistakes that have ramifications for years and years and years. The old school way was get them to college, where they get thrown into the blender of finance, and then they just get eaten up.
Yeah.
And then they have all these problems, and they have bad habits, and it's a total disaster. And it leads to, I don't know, national debt all-time high, consumer debt all-time high, student loan debt all-time high. Mm-hmm. Oh, that kind of sounds like where we're at right now in the world, right?
Yeah, you make a lot of good points. A lot of good points.
This is something you got to start early and just let them practice for 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, and honestly, I mean, I know that money is tight, but $48 is nothing. I mean, I look at people will spend $48 in a week just going to Dunkin' Donuts. I'm sorry, to go get their coffees. Like, it's to me, if it means your children are financially stable by the time they leave your home, that's a huge win. That's a huge win.
Yeah, it's a little tiny investment. And let's put it this way. Hey, then they might have more money than you have, and you can get a loan from them.
Or they could say, hey, thanks, Mom and Dad, for getting me financially stable. Here's a free trip to, and then you get to pick it. That would be great.
Yeah. I'd love that. I like that. I'd love that. I'm going to bring that up to one of my kids.
Yeah, well, and you have a zillion of them. So if they combine the amount of money you invested in making sure that they were financially stable, that should easily, but between the six of them, they should be able to send you to Italy or somewhere very exciting, extravagant.
Sounds
like
an exotic trip in my future.
I'm very excited for you, Greg. And because I gave you the idea, if you wanted to, you know, bring another person with you, I totally understand. I will accept graciously. No problem.
I'm sure you'd be fun. Sure you'd be fun, too. So.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. I have some factoids here. We're talking to Greg Merced, who is the creator of Busy Kid, but also a certified financial planner, talking to us about the importance of teaching our children financial skills at a young age and at home. The National Financial Educators Council released their state-by-state data recently for their annual National Financial Literacy Test. Here in Connecticut, participants between the ages of 15 and 18, so you're talking sophomore in high school to even freshman in college, only averaged 64%, which is an overall failing grade. It's really troubling. So this is something we have hard-based data showing on average that our teens are not prepared financially. They are not prepared.
And we all kind of knew that at a gut level, right? We just kind of did. And we always think, I know a lot, I talk to so many parents and they're like, why don't they teach this stuff in school, right? And it's like, you know, why do we? We teach them French, but we don't teach them like money, personal finance.
Right.
It seems like a crazy thing, right? And so you can't just sit there and cuss the school for not teaching it. You got to take this bull by the horns as a parent and say, all right, I'm going to teach them. And here, let me give you a quick tip. Like, this is a super easy one. And I know, like, parents get really freaked out about teaching their kids about money. But next time you're sitting on the couch with them and ding, your phone, you know, has an email come in and it happens to be your electric bill or your auto insurance bill or whatever bill, say, hey, come over here. I want you to help me pay this bill together. Like, all of a sudden, they're going to think, you know, in my case, oh my, we live in Phoenix, it's August, and it costs $600 to like keep the power on in our house. Like, that's going to open their eyes in a huge way. And all of a sudden, they're going to not only be blown away, but they're going to appreciate money just a little bit more. And maybe that's going to inspire them to like do better in school and get a better job one day. Like, it's a snowball effect. And that all happened by saying, come over here, I want to help you, I want you to help me pay a bill.
Like, yeah.
It's not that hard, people.
Yeah. You know what it is, Greg, is I do, and again, this is sort of an opinion of what I see from my age group of parents. I'm in my mid-30s, so I typically, you know, am with other kids who are in my son's class, like their parents. And I know they think I'm crazy. My father is a health insurance broker. So he, you know, growing up, he was very honest about, you know, for example, how much health insurance is. And I can remember being like 8, 9 years old and being like, man, why do we spend so much on health insurance? And yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
And he would compare like, okay, if you don't have health insurance, Melissa, here's how much a hospital stay is going to be. With your health insurance, this is what the hospital stay is going to be. And I'm like, wow, that's crazy. You know, because again, like your children, they lived in a household where this mattered to you and you knew what it looked like. And for some reason, you know, so my son sometimes, because, you know, Nona and Papa, they're wonderful people. They will just hand him money because he looked at them the right way. You know, you got to love grandparents.
Oh, yeah, he's cute.
He's adorable, right?
No,
You get it. So, you know, so my mom hands Chase $20. This was a few months ago. And he says, I want to go to the toy store. I said, all right, you want to go to the toy store? You want to use your $20? All right, fine. I said, before we use your $20, though, do you mind if we just stop home really quickly? Because I get the email showing what mail comes in. And he goes, yeah, sure. So we stop home. I get a couple of bills in the mail. And one of them is for his preschool. And his preschool is a pretty penny every single month. And then we also got one that was sort of like what you were saying. It was like an electric bill, something like that. I said, between these two bills, bud, I go, I'm going to need a good 40 of your $20 bills easily. And he's like, whoa, you know, so whatever. I kid you not, Greg. He probably got this $20 bill back in November from my parents. He still has not spent the whole thing because he's so, and he's only 4 and a half. But like, we've gone to the toy store, the poor guy who owns the toy store, he's, you know, Chase is going around. He's like, how much is this? And he's like, oh, $16.99. So you can afford it. He's like, that's too much of my money going away. What, how much is this? It's hysterical though. And the guy's like, whoa, dude. And he just, it's not worth it, Mom. We'll come back another day when there are more toys. I'm like, all right, well, don't be a jerk. but it's
you're
true.
Doing good.
Oh, well,
okay,
thanks.
You're doing good. Yeah. This is what I mean. You're proving the point, right? Be transparent with your kids, and they'll be like different kids.
But parents are too scared to do that, though, Greg. Like, they're like, oh, don't burden your children with those amounts. And I'm like, why? I'm not burdening him. Yeah. I'm just informing him, I think.
Plunge them into vast depression about health insurance costs. I like the strategy.
Right? Do you love how my father did that? Yeah. Yeah.
No, you don't want to stress them out so bad that they can't function in life.
Right.
But being transparent enough to where they start getting it and honestly being appreciative of what you're doing for them. And this is why mom, this is why dad goes out and busts it out every day at work. Like, this is good things, and this is preparing them for reality. That's all that is.
Yeah. And I think you're right, too, Greg. You know, a lot of the times I do find in this society, I know we're a pleasing society now. And again, I don't want to stress my kid out. And I certainly do an awful lot wrong. I know that for a fact. But, you know,
I doubt it.
No, I do. I promise you. I mean, let's talk about the fact that you were up at 4 a.m. for this interview. So there you go. But I do find that the fights that other parents have with their kids, I have different fights with my son because he's a 4 and a half year old. But the fights like, hey, do you think we can go and, you know, see a movie today, Mom? And then do you think we could do this? Yeah, I think we can. We can afford that. Hey, Mom. You know, my brother lives down in Disney. Hey, Mom, do you think we can afford to go to Disney in the next couple of months? No, buddy, I don't. I don't think we can afford to get on a plane, go down there, even though we're staying with Uncle Matt, and go into the parks for one day. I don't think it's going to happen until next year. Okay. And that's the end of it. That's the end of the conversation with a 4 and a half year old. And I don't always see that with other kids. You know, the financial thing, that's so a little reality, I think, has to be helpful.
A reality check is a good thing for a kid, absolutely, and it makes them a little bit more grateful. Mm. And who doesn't want that out of their kid?
Yeah,
having lived many, many years with all these kids, that's what you want. You want them to be grateful, for heaven's sakes. I mean, you're working hard to make it all happen. So, you know, don't shy away from it. Embrace it. It's not that hard. And like I said, if you're fairly consistent, like, you don't have to be perfect at this. And, you know, you'll have the occasional spring break where you just go wild.
Mm-hmm.
Who cares? You'll be fine. But if you're fairly consistent, they will get it, and they'll be all the better for it. And then they'll get out of your house. Yay.
Yeah. I love this.
That's the goal.
I love having a structure, too. Like, I'm very excited. I very much plan to do Busy Kid, see what it's like, try it with my son. I think clearly you've seen it with, you know, your own children, the success of it. I didn't even ask you when you created this, Greg. When did you make this?
So Busy Kid has been around formally for about 3 years.
Wow.
I've been teaching the principles to my kids forever.
But, right.
It's literally something that we just saw a need, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like, okay, we've got to get this need filled because it really changes the trajectory of a kid's life when they start to understand this stuff. And you mentioned, you know, grandma just handed them over $20, right? When you're spending other people's money, it's a little bit different, but when that money becomes yours and you had to earn it and you got to kind of be the steward of it, watch out, because they're going to do that exactly what your son did. He's going to like be pretty picky about it.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what you want to do. So if you can start that early, watch out. They're going to do really well.
That's a good point. Greg Merced, I'm so glad you created Busy Kid. Can't wait to start it myself. And I thank you so much for coming on during April's Financial Literacy Month. Really, really great stuff.
Good to be with you, Melissa.
And if you want to go back to sleep, I totally understand. So enjoy. Greg Merced here on WICC. I never was very good at math, but I'm hoping I got this right. I believe this year is the 70th anniversary of the nonprofit organization Ability Beyond. They help thousands of people every year living with disabilities here in Connecticut as well as New York. It was created here in our state back in 1953. The mission of Ability Beyond is to support people in need with programs that could be behavioral, employment, even daytime activities, among many other resources that are offered. And according to its website, Ability Beyond has forefront innovation and high standard practices that are apparently recognized and modeled on state and national levels. So I am very honored to have Jane Davis here this morning, who is the CEO of Ability Beyond. And one of the reasons I had first contacted them in the last few weeks, I think it was back in March, was because I know April is Autism Awareness Month, which you and I both know is very important to me. But I like to expand it beyond just autism and just talk about, in general, people who need resources or support because of something they were diagnosed with or something that they have developed. And so I'm so honored to have, for the first time on the show, Ability Beyond's CEO, Jane Davis. Hey, Jane, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much. Tell us what got started with Ability Beyond, because it sounds like the nonprofit has been around for a very long time.
Yeah, you did your math correctly.
Oh, thank
God. We're celebrating our 70th this year. We started in 1953 with a small group of families in the Danbury area who had children with disabilities, developmental disabilities, and at that time, it wasn't a thing to have a guaranteed spot in public schools. Inclusion had not taken off, so they were really just getting together to look for a better life for their children with disabilities. That's how they started.
And I think, too, and the only reason, Jane, that I sort of know this is because luckily my brother was sort of born in the era where this wasn't as common. He was born in the early 90s, but my younger mm-hmm. brother's on the spectrum for autism. And my mom, who was a registered nurse forever, she still is registered. When she was a nurse and was working, you know, just getting her RN, a lot of times, especially in the 70s and 80s, kids were just institutionalized, correct?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that wasn't
right.
So I would think that also kind of plays a role. Like it was very all or nothing. It was either they can be mainstreamed in the schools without any services, or they were put in an institution.
That's right. And these families were trying to provide the third alternative, which was to get extra support, services that you need in the community. So at the time, it was at the forefront, really.
Wow. So tell us, if you don't mind, kind of dive a little bit more into the programs that you can be offered if you're part of Ability Beyond.
Sure. I mean, we started with that little group of families, and today it's pretty amazing. We're in Connecticut. We're in Westchester, Putnam, and Dutchess in New York. We're serving people on the autism spectrum, people with developmental disabilities, people who are acquired brain injury survivors, and people with mental illness and challenges in that way. So we've expanded whom we serve, where we serve them, and we're providing day programs, residential programs. We have hundreds of group homes in both states. We have transition services for young adults looking to transition from high school to the working world. We have transportation, Special Olympics. We have an outpatient clinic. We do just about anything that a person needs to thrive in their community.
How much does it cost, Jane Davis, CEO of Ability Beyond, how much does it cost for a family to say, hey, my child or my young adult son or daughter is in need of some of your resources? How much does it cost them to use the resources and services of Ability Beyond?
So for the most part, for the families that we serve, we are almost all Medicaid. So there's no cost to the families for most of the services that we provide. We do some private pay. We have behavioral support services and things that you can learn more about on our website, abilitybeyond.org. But most of what we do is paid through Medicaid. These are long-term care services that help people be independent. So for usually, there's no cost. It is expensive care. Some of the people that we serve in our facilities receive 24-hour care with lots of clinical support, nursing, PT, physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, dietary services, behavioral support services. It's very, very high-level clinical care for some of the people we serve. But again, it is Medicaid, so no cost to families usually, but it also means that we're relying on fundraising to support us and to do it the way that we believe it should be done.
What age range do you serve?
You know, it's most of the people that we serve are adults, but we also do some young adult work, and usually 14 and up, and mostly adults, but we do work in school systems. We have great Project Search programs that are actually working with students to help them gain work experience while they're studying. So it's it depends on the service.
And my understanding, Jane, and correct me if I'm wrong, but for example, your employment program, it's not just as simple as, hey, let's connect you to your closest grocery store, or let's get you in the mailroom of somewhere to do it. I mean, I for some, and I might have gotten this wrong, but isn't Ability Beyond connected to like Fortune 500 companies that are offering opportunities to some folks?
Yep, I'm glad you asked that. So we have almost 70 years of experience with employment and helping a person with a disability connect with their dream job and helping the employer welcome them into their work site. And almost 8 years ago, we decided to leverage that experience and take hold of the DEIB movement and make sure that people remember disability when they're thinking of that. And we started with a grant with Pepsi, and today we're working with over 70 huge companies, not just nationally, but a few are international.
Wow.
And we are helping them welcome people with disabilities into their employment. So locally in Connecticut and New York, we help 3,000 people a year in all of our service lines, and thousands of those are through employment services. We just reached 7,000 through our consulting, which is Disability Solutions. And in addition to that, we've trained 10,000 people leaders in disability inclusion. And we have the biggest network, we believe the biggest network of community partners, 11,000 and counting, with community-based talent partners that help connect people with disabilities with employment.
Wow.
Really great, really fun. And it furthers our mission. It is all about disability employment and inclusion. And it helps support Ability Beyond and the work that we do every day.
Jane Davis is here this morning, the CEO of Ability Beyond, a nonprofit organization based right here in Connecticut. It has expanded to also offering services in New York. 70 years this year. Jane, what an incredible milestone. Why do you think Ability Beyond has been so successful and has lasted as long as it has?
You know, I think that we always seem to be getting ahead of the work that needs to be done at the time that people need us. And that those numbers are growing substantially every year. It's pretty incredible. There are thousands of people in both states on waiting lists, really, really in need of services. So we are always growing. And then our national work is so great because people really want and thrive with employment. And that's one of our specialty areas. So I think we try and be top notch. We believe in excellence in the services that we provide. We have great relationships with our community partners, and people need us.
Yeah, there's a great need, certainly. And again, I salute the work that you all do. What would you say, Jane, are some of the biggest accomplishments in recent years for Ability Beyond?
You know, I think I mentioned it before, we're so proud of the work of our team of Disability Solutions. That's been a really incredible addition to what we can offer, not just here, but it brings our presence nationally. We're incredibly proud of that. I think the other thing that we love to be known for is innovation. We have, we're Medicaid funded, so it's never quite enough for what you need to do things well. And so we try to be as efficient as possible. And we've done things like develop our own Ability app internally that helps use our staff efficiently and help connect them with their qualifications and the open shifts. We're filling thousands and thousands of shifts every month at Ability Beyond, so we have to do that efficiently. We can't spend all of our time on the phone scheduling, so that's helped us. We have an incredible protocol app for the people we serve to make sure that staff have the right information in their hands so that they can do things correctly and provide the right service. That's been incredible and really helped to drive quality for us. And we have an incredible behavior talent app that connects the clinician with the data that's being entered live, and it uses an algorithm that we're really proud of that was developed in-house by Patrick Queenan, our head of clinical services and our IT department. And it has really incredibly driven our results for behavioral supports internally. So we're proud of all of that work that gets done every day on the ground, but some of the innovations have been really, really, really cool.
Mm-hmm. And tell us, if you don't mind, Jane is the CEO of Ability Beyond. Do you have offices all over Connecticut? I know you have specific ones in New York, but are there access points all over Connecticut or just a specific location?
So we have our headquarters in Connecticut is in Bethel. Mm-hmm. Our headquarters in New York is in Chappaqua in the old Reader's Digest building. We have a great office in Norwalk, right on the green. We have an office in Waterbury, and we have an office in Plainville, near Bristol in Connecticut. So those are some office spaces. We also have tons and tons of little embedded offices in hospitals and state buildings where we just have a tiny bit of office space. And for the most part, our team of 1,200 people are out there every day in the communities providing support. So we are in one of our 100 group homes. We're in apartment buildings, supporting people in their own apartments. We're in family homes. And then, of course, we're in hundreds and hundreds of employment locations, helping people on the ground with support that they need at work.
And I would imagine you also offer virtual services.
We do. We offer virtual day program services. We have virtual, sometimes clinical supports, behavioral supports. And we are doing that work every day as well. We especially did that during the pandemic. We're a lot happier when we're in person,
sure,
supporting the person, but we do both.
Mm-hmm. And you've mentioned day programs a couple of times. What do you mean by day programs?
Well, most of the work that we do is in employment. So we really are our drive for most people that we serve is to find employment for them. And we want it to be with an already thriving business in the community, and we want it to be something they're interested and passionate about. So that is most of the work that we do. But sometimes a lot of work goes into prepping people for that. So we have programs where people come during the day, and sometimes if they balance in their day of a little bit of clinical work, some community participation, maybe they're volunteering, maybe they're experiencing different work sites, just to get a feel for what they might even be interested in. Oftentimes people come out of the school systems and they really don't have any work experience, and they need to experience, you know, check things out, see what connects with them.
I was curious too, Jane, are there any volunteer opportunities and donation opportunities if people want to give?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're hosting our 70th Platinum Jubilee Gala this Saturday night. And people can bid on auction items. They can do a donation. They can do a sponsorship for that. All that information is on the events section at abilitybeyond.org. We love getting donations. We love community partners. If employers are out there and they're interested in helping to meet their job gap needs with a committed employee, let us know. We are always looking for those kind of partnerships. We're always looking for team members. So if you're interested in employment with us and making a difference in your community, check us out. All of that information is at abilitybeyond.org.
And our applications, if you have an 18 plus, a family member or somebody, you'd love to get into one of these programs or to get use the resources, even things like resume building, for example. Are there applications you can find online as well?
You can find all of that information. All you have to do is fill out the Apply Now portion on our website. And you can learn more about all of the services that we offer on our website as well. And you just fill out that simple form, and then someone from our team will reach out to you.
Amazing. It's called Ability Beyond, and their website is abilitybeyond.org. And Jane Davis, I really thank you, the CEO, for the work that you and your massive team, what you do for thousands of people here in Connecticut and New York. I thank you for what you do and for Ability Beyond in such a milestone, 70 years in the work that's been done over the decades. It's really quite extraordinary. So thank you for that.
It's a joy to do it, and we have an amazing team, and we love what we do, and thank you so much for having us this morning.
Oh, absolutely. You're welcome back anytime, Jane. Thank you for your time. State Representatives Dorinda Borer and Nicole Claritas-Dittrea co-chair the Women's Bipartisan Caucus right here in the Connecticut General Assembly, and recently the group unveiled its 2023 legislative priorities, and we wanted to share them with you here on the show. So good morning to both representatives here this morning. So glad you're here. How are you?
Morning. How are you this morning?
I'm great. Thank you so much.
Morning,
and I know,
Nicole.
Yeah, Dorinda, I know I've had
Hi,
on the
Dorinda.
Show. Nicole, welcome. I've never had you on the show
thank
before.
You.
Glad to have you here. Yes, thank you so
glad
much.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Good. I'm glad. So it looks like I have a nice long list of different bills that are being presented. Well, should I ask this question, Dorinda, first? Have these already been in some way, shape, or form presented to the legislature, or are these brand new bills that no one had seen before?
These are bills that actually have already come out of committee.
Okay.
So for a bill, you know, to become a law, you need to, the bill needs to go through the committee process, a public hearing, and then a vote by the committee members. And then it goes to the House, and then it goes to the Senate, and then it goes to the governor. So we wait until the bills come out of the committee because we like to see the public hearing and bills evolve while they're in committee. So they have two more steps to go, but this is quite a they've already achieved quite an accomplishment getting out of the committee.
Now, some of these stand out to me because I've had them in my news before of either going through the committee or getting out of there. For example, the expansion of maternal health care access and affordability, a person not being less than 18 years old to be eligible to marry. Like, I've seen some of these before, decreasing mm-hmm. the gender wage gap. Tell us, if you don't mind, Nicole, why don't you share with us some of the ones that stand out to you as these need to passed this year. These cannot get passed up because, as I mentioned, I do see it's a semi-long list. Very important things, though. But what cannot get passed? Like, what's a non-negotiable?
I mean, in Hartford, you know, everything is negotiable.
Yes.
I mean,
true.
Compromise is how we get most things passed in Hartford, and a lot, and bipartisan is the best way to do that. You may get a bill that you like 100%. Or it may be 50%, and these bills, as Dorinda will say, I'm sure, they're all works in progress. And at the end of the day, when these bills hopefully do come for a vote, that doesn't mean we're going to support them. I know some of my Republican colleagues, we have issues with these bills and we want to fix them. So hopefully everybody can vote for them. Me personally, the minimum age to marry, 18 years, that's been a big bill that we tried to pass for a few years. We adjusted it a few years ago to 16 and 17-year-olds, and that's pretty important. The palliative care one, we all know that with Aiden dying and hospice care, that's a pilot program. The palliative care one that Senator Summers has been a big champion working with to make, you know, to make parity with palliative care in a hospital setting, to make that same care that you could get in your home for yourself or your loved one at the end of life.
Okay. And for you, Dorinda, are there ones that stand out to you that you feel need to pass, you know, more than others per se? Like, I know all of these obviously are major items for you both, but something that stands out for you?
Yeah, so just by way of background, there's a few thousand bills that are submitted each session, so narrowing it down to the 10 to begin with was difficult.
Yes, I'm
and
sure.
It doesn't mean that there's not so many other great bills out there that we're all supporting. Mm-hmm. We just asked the women, you know, based on their collective conversations in their districts, what has stood out to them. And I would say within this 10 list, within the bills on this list of 10, probably the protections against response to domestic violence. Because we see far too many women that are murdered because there can be more protections in place. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is, I don't want to say an easy bill, but it's something that I think is very reasonable to implement. There are common sense measures that will help women in our state. And then early childhood, because that's really the foundation prior to education. It identifies issues with children and it really sets the stage and also helps with their health care. It's no longer dropping your child off at your neighbor's house or grandma's house. These are early childhood providers that really evaluate social, emotional, and educational needs. So it's hard to pick. I like them all.
Yeah,
And
the domestic violence one that Dorinda said, and that's something that we hear unfortunately every day,
mm-hmm.
and it's a women's issue, but it's a man's issue as well because we don't want any domestic violence to happen to mother, son, brother, sister, wife, friend. It's just something that we need to put in the forefront and protect. as much as possible.
Yeah, certainly. And again, we're talking to State Representatives Dorinda Borer as well as Nicole Claritas-Dittria. And I'm so glad to have you both here because I know you both co-chair the Women's Bipartisan Caucus in Connecticut's General Assembly. But I also, as I'm looking at these bills, ladies, I noticed that they're not all just female based bills, essentially. They're not all just targeting, or I should say supporting, you know, to put it simply, women's rights here in Connecticut, which I think is really interesting. And so if you can hold on, we're going to come back and talk about a few more of these. One that I thought was interesting is the dignity of passing away at home, the I always say this incorrectly, but being able to assist. I mean, I don't like calling it assisted suicide. I really don't like that term. I really don't like it. I know a lot of people call it that and that's what it's known for. But I see that's on your list. Another one that speaks, you know, to my heart personally is being able to expand the workforce and giving people with certain disabilities more of an opportunity to get more qualifying jobs in the state, which I'm a huge proponent of. I'm very grateful to have State Representatives Dorinda Borer and Nicole Claritas-Dittria here. And just so everyone knows, Dorinda representing West Haven, Nicole for Beacon Falls, Derby, Seymour, all of our listening area. So very exciting to have you both here. They also are the co-chairs of the Women's Bipartisan Caucus in Connecticut's General Assembly. So we were talking about a list of bills. There are 10 of them here that were presented last week. And just talking about, they've already been out of committee, so they need to make some moves before the session wraps up in a matter of weeks. I was pointing out before the break, ladies, that there are some pieces of legislation that actually are not just specific to women here in Connecticut. For example, the providing dignity to hospice care patients by allowing them to pass away comfortably in their home. Now, is that different than the bill, as I'm reading it out loud, the bill of the death by choice, essentially? Is that different than that, or are we talking about the same piece of legislation?
Yes, they're two different bills.
Thank you for clarifying.
There's the aid in dying bill, and this is the hospice and palliative care.
Okay.
So what this bill does is it has the Department of Public Health to collaborate with DSS and one hospital in the state to be determined. And what they're going to do is they're going to establish a hospice hospital at home pilot program. So this pilot program will provide in-home hospice care to patients through a combination of visits and telehealth. Because what we've heard with aid in dying is people are saying that hospice care or end-of-life care in the hospital isn't the same as when you're having hospice or end-of-life care in your home. And we want to bring parity. We want people to have that same experience that they have in the hospital as they do at home, because we've heard family members complain that that's a big concern. So we're trying to get that, you know, taken care of. And by having insurance covering it, we think that'll be a great pilot program to figure what's going on with hospitals versus home hospice care.
And what about the bill that is encouraging state agencies to use funding, reducing wait lists, establishing adequate workforce to serve intellectual and developmental disability populations? I was saying this is something that touches my heart very dearly because my younger brother is autistic, and he actually could not have gotten out of Connecticut faster because he felt, and this was years and years ago, my brother's already 30, but when he graduated high school, it was, you know, even down to the level of his teachers and his guidance counselors basically telling him, you know, you'll never drive, you'll never, you know, basically amount to ever going to college. It was very dumbed down for him, and he's high functioning. And so he couldn't have hightailed it out of here faster. He's been in Florida now for over 10 years, working for Walt Disney World, driving, went to college for two years, you know, defied what Connecticut would have called, you know, the odds. But really, it just didn't seem like he had the opportunities he could have had. So anytime I see bills like this pop up, I'm always very intrigued by it. So could you explain it a little bit more to me?
Yeah, you know, I could take a stab at that. And it sounds like, you know, and your younger brother is thriving and doing really well. And I think clearly we all can agree that we need to do a better job here in Connecticut for our IDD population, which is intellectual and development disability population. And when you think about the families that have a family member with IDD, it's such a heavy lift. And we need to support those families in addition to the individuals. So, workforce, transportation, day programs, there's a lot of areas that we can do to provide for a productive and a great quality life for our IDD population and help the family as well. So asking the state agencies to recommend new service eligibility criteria that does not just hinge on an IQ test and looks at the individual as a whole. And we also want to reduce the waiting list. We want to provide funding for the waiting list. You know, when a student with IDD ages out, they call it, right? There's not a lot of places or programs for that young adult to participate in. And this is a really great bipartisan effort by Rep. Dathan and Representative Case, and it's a priority bill for the House of Representatives.
So from here, what are the chances, from your professional opinions, of these items moving on? And again, I know that's a kind of a tall task to ask you because we're talking about 10 pieces, but do these have enough support? Like I see here on the list, for example, the access to emergency contraception from a vending machine. I have to imagine that's going to be a very controversial one for sure. And not just because
I mean, yes, some of them are controversial. And like I said earlier in the show, some of our members, you know, just may never vote for them, no matter what changes you make to them.
Right.
And that's part of the process, and that's okay. This bill is important. The contraception bill is important to a lot of people. Dorinda, who's the other one? DCP also has a bill that will address this emergency contraception. So over-the-counter drugs, which emergency contraception currently is an over-the-counter drug. So that's a bill that's possibly going through that will address this as well.
Well, I thank you both
I was just going to say, that bill was surprisingly bipartisan.
Interesting.
At first glance, you think it would be, you know, pretty partisan, but I was pleasantly surprised at the votes that came out of the Public Health Committee.
The reason I thought it wouldn't be, honestly, is not even because of what's going on in the nation with abortion pills and all of that. That's actually not even why I was thinking it. The reason was because when the FDA, for example, gave the green light for Narcan, which I'm in support of, I know there are some people who are not, which that's perfectly fine. But there are calls for even things like melatonin that you don't need a prescription for. And are we going too far to making things too accessible without contacting your doctor ahead of time? So that's actually why I thought the vending machine thing would have been controversial, is because of that aspect, not really the like the birth control abortion and all that we're going
right
through in the nation.
But
yeah.
Also, to that argument, emergency contraception, you can already get it over the counter. You
right
don't need a prescription, and there's no age limit currently.
Right.
The FDA changed that, I believe, in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're still able to get it. Now you're just going to be able to get it in a vending machine. And
right,
actually, this bill only makes it allowable on college campuses. So it's a narrower window of where you can get it. The DCP, the Department of Consumer Protection bill, has it enables it anywhere. So there are two different aspects to that bill as well.
Interesting. Ladies, unfortunately, we have run out of time, but I would love to have you back on the show, especially to update us on some of these items or all of them. And I thank you for your time.
Sure. And
thank you,
Melissa,
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Melissa.
Yeah, no problem. And I appreciate having you on the show. And certainly, like I said, come back whenever you want. State Representatives Dorinda Borer and Nicole Claritas-Ditria here on WICC.